Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Dr. Max Baker-Hite, who's a tutorial fellow in philosophy at Oxford University. And he's published numerous academic papers and has recently released a book with Cambridge University Press called God and the Problem of Evidential Ambiguity. Max, let's talk about the moral argument, because that's one that people often draw on from C.S. Lewis. But before we start delving into the sort of nitty gritty bits of it, would you mind summarising some of Lewis's arguments? I suppose probably where he lays it out most clearly is at the start of Mere Christianity. But would you just summarise for us what he means by the argument from morality?
Yeah, of course. So, yes, it's in those first kind of five chapters of Mere Christianity, where basically the core idea is that when we reflect on the ways we conduct our lives and the way we get indignant about the ways people treat us in certain situations, he makes the case that that doesn't make sense to react in that sort of way unless there is some kind of objective moral law that isn't just true in virtue of our preferences and desires. And so, for example, he gives the example of being tripped up. So almost all of us will react very differently if the person deliberately tripped us up as compared with if they tripped us up accidentally. And he suggests that that's quite difficult to make sense of unless we are presupposing some notion of a proper way to behave, that isn't just a matter of sort of preferences and so on. And then he wants to go on to argue that this moral law, as he calls it, makes better sense if there is a person or some sort of being that is non-physical and that is more like a person than anything else behind it.
So do we have any idea where Lewis drew some of these ideas from while he was developing his argument from morality?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm not aware of him having explicitly cited his influences for this, but it seems very likely to me that he at least had Immanuel Kant in mind as a particularly important philosopher who does use this term, the moral law, to talk about a set of obligations that we are under, whether we like it or not, what Kant called the categorical imperative. So it's not that, you know, if I want to have a happy life and if I want to get along well in the world, I should do X. It's rather, I should do X, full stop. And so that's, for Kant, the categorical imperative is the content of this moral law. And so I suspect that Lewis was at least partly influenced by Kant.
Yeah. I mean, how compelling do you think this argument is, Max?
Well, I think certainly the first part of it, where he tries to argue that, you know, as I said, we act and think in ways that only make sense on the assumption there is an objective moral law. I think that is compelling. Then you've got the second stage of the argument, which tries to say that moral law is a set of objective truths about what we ought and ought not to do, makes more sense if there's a person behind the universe than if not. And I do think there is something to that. That's the bit that I'm a little less sure about in terms of the force of that inference. And as we might talk about in a minute, there certainly are kind of philosophers who want to grant that there is an objective moral law, but who don't think we need to ground it in God. And I do think that, you know, some of those philosophers have made a case that is worthy of reflection. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think intuitively there is something there, but I don't think it's totally clear cut.
I mean, presumably Lewis thought it was really important in that he put it right at the beginning of the book. I mean, obviously the book is based on radio broadcast, but he does devote a huge chunk of Near Christianity to it. So he obviously thought it was quite a compelling argument.
Yeah, I think that's right. The thing that I appreciate about his presentation of that argument, though, is that he is quite nuanced about what it gets you to. He doesn't try and say that it gets you to classical theism, you know, the God with all of the omni attributes, let alone Christian theism. He just says that, you know, it gets you something that's like a mind. And so, yeah, I think you're right. He definitely did think that there was force to this argument, but I do think he was appropriately cautious about how far it gets you.
Yeah. What are some of those main objections and critiques to this argument from morality then, Max?
Yeah, so, I mean, basically, one of the main objections is going to be that objective moral truths don't need to be grounded in anything. And I suppose Eric Weilenberg is the philosopher who has sort of done the most to promote this position. And so Eric Weilenberg is an atheist, but he's an objectivist about ethics. So he basically agrees with the first part of Lewis's argument. But Weilenberg's point is that theism doesn't offer an advantage in explaining objective morality as compared with atheism. An atheistic picture in which objective moral truths are just there, if, as it were, as brute facts, maybe akin to mathematical truths. And the reason Weilenberg claims that theism doesn't have an advantage there is that he says that theism also needs to have some brute moral facts, such as that God's commands ought to be obeyed, and that truth itself isn't grounded in God. And there's been some back and forth on that between Weilenberg and some theist philosophers. But yeah, I think that's going to be one of the sort of strongest objections to it.
Max, other than moral laws just existing and just being brute facts, the other thing is that there are perhaps alternative explanations for the origin of these universal moral laws. And Lewis actually cites some of these in Mere Christianity, one of which is herd instinct. And he talks about why, in his opinion, the herd instinct is not a sufficient explanation. So this is what C.S. Lewis says in Miracles. Of course, we sometimes do feel just the sort of desire to help another person, and no doubt that desire is due to the herd instinct. But feeling a desire to help is quite different from feeling that you ought to help, whether you want to or not. And then there's a bit where he talks about you having like two conflicting desires in yourself. Mm-hmm. One is to help and one is to keep out of danger, the sort of self-preservation side of things. And then he says that you've got a third one, which basically tells you that you ought to follow the impulse to help and suppress the impulse to run away. So that's where he differentiates between actually there is something else at play here. And for him, that's the moral law.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting response. I think he's onto something there. This might be slightly related to what he's getting at there, but acts of extreme altruism might also challenge the herd instinct explanation. And I know there have been some attempts to try and give a sort of evolutionary explanation of even extreme altruism. But those are very, very speculative explanations. So, yeah, I mean, one of the examples that's sometimes given is that the man, when that ferry sank, the Herald of Free Enterprise, there was a man who basically used his body as a gangplank to let passengers escape to safety to the lifeboats, and he died. And that none of them were related to him, you know. And so that sort of thing seems kind of difficult to explain in this sort of evolutionary psychology fashion. So I think something else I think often gets a bit muddied in these discussions is what is it that we're trying to explain? Is it that we're trying to explain why humans believe that there is objective morality? Or is it that we're trying to explain objective moral truths? And I would suggest that evolutionary psychological explanations, herd instinct conventions, and so on, all of those pertain to why humans believe that there is objective morality. They don't, as it were, explain objective moral truths. Now, I suspect what many people who push those explanations would say is there are no objective moral truths. And so when I say I'm explaining morality, really what I mean is I'm explaining human moral beliefs. Mm. And that's okay. But I think we just really need, we need to be really clear what it is that we're trying to explain. And so if like Eric Weilenberg, as I said, who's an atheist, who is persuaded there are objective moral truths, any number of psychological or evolutionary accounts aren't going to explain why there are objective moral truths in the universe. At most, they would explain why we think there are.
Yeah, that's a really helpful differentiation. And I think there's a quote from Miracles again, which I think makes it really clear, where C.S. Lewis says, "The reason why your idea of New York can be truer or less true than mine is that New York is a real place, yeah, existing quite apart from what either of us thinks."
Yes. Yes, no, absolutely. That's right. And so if there are objective moral truths, that they are as mind independent as the Statue of Liberty, etc. Yeah.
So let's move on to the second part of what he was talking about, which you very helpfully sort of laid out for us when you were talking about the summary of what he says in Miracles. What can we then deduce about the nature or the attributes of the moral lawgiver, if there is in fact a moral lawgiver? Does the law of nature necessarily point to a personal God, a Christian God, the God that Lewis believes in? Or is it just a sort of general, as you said, intellectual mind outside of the universe?
So, yeah, I mean, I think Lewis's caution is appropriate there. And he says, you know, I'm not yet within 100 miles of the God of Christian theology. And so, the attributes that he gives to that moral lawgiver are essentially consciousness. He's not willing to go that much further. I think some philosophers who like moral arguments would want to say that in order to be able to be the ground of morality, to be the ground of moral truth, God himself would have to have moral qualities. That's kind of entailed by that. So if you go with the sort of theory that the philosopher Robert Adams has outlined, and where basically God is kind of the paradigm of goodness, and finite things are good to the extent that they resemble God's nature. And actually, I think Lewis would have been very sympathetic to this. Some things he says imply that he did have thoughts in that direction. And so if God is the ground of moral truth in that way, then you do also get some divine attributes having to do with God's moral goodness there as well.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Bird, co-host of the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast, and I want to ask you, what exactly is the gospel? You'd think Christians would generally agree on this, but actually, there are some rich and important differences in how the gospel can be understood. That's why I edited with Jason Maston a new book called 5 Views on the Gospel, part of the Counterpoint series from Zondervan Academic. We've gathered together 5 absolutely brilliant scholars: Michael Horton, Scott McKnight, David DeSilva, Julie Ma, and Shively Smith, each offering a different take on what the gospel really is. Justification by faith, declaring Jesus is king, spiritual transformation, liberation from oppression. I mean, each view is, in a sense, rooted in scripture and history and contemporary mission, but they don't always agree. This book explores, what are we saved from? What are we saved for? And what does it mean to live a life worthy of the gospel? Whether you're a preacher, a student, or just curious, 5 Views on the Gospel will challenge and deepen your understanding of the good news of Jesus Christ. Available now wherever good theology books are sold.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. There's a really interesting sort of differentiation that he makes about God being outside the universe, but then also inside the universe. And he talks about the moral law being him effectively being inside the universe because he's inside us. So I'll just give you a little quote. So this is from Miracles, where he says, "We have 2 bits of evidence about the somebody. One is the universe that he's made. The other bit of evidence is the moral law which he's put into our minds. And this is a better bit of evidence than the other because it's inside information. Yeah. You find out more about God from the moral law than from the universe in general, just as you find out more about a man by listening to his conversation than by looking at a house he's built." So that definitely sounds a lot more personal than this kind of outside mind, doesn't it? I mean, is that what he was trying to, clearly, as you say, he's still quite far away from the Christian God and Jesus and all of that, but it sounds like it's not quite just out there.
No, I think that's a really good quote to have focused on, and it reminds me of something actually that relates to a philosophical debate about why God isn't more obvious, sometimes known as the divine hiddenness debate. And Paul Moser is a philosopher who's argued that essentially, if we don't find enough evidence for God's existence, it's because we're looking for the wrong sort of evidence. And he makes this contrast between spectator evidence, which is kind of clues of design in the universe, and what he calls volitional evidence, where it somehow impacts upon your will. And in order to kind of really be attentive to this evidence, you have to be in a certain moral posture and willingness to submit to God as a kind of moral authority. And so Moser especially emphasizes the evidence he thinks we should be looking for is that kind of God speaking to us through the voice of conscience, which actually it does very much mirror that distinction Lewis is making there.
Yeah, that is really helpful. I mean, one of the things that we've mentioned is the kind of objectivism of moral laws that exist, objective moral truths. How do you think some of this resonates with a society that we're in now that is, to a certain extent, a bit more relativistic, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting. I I guess I would say that Lewis would look at a society like ours and probably say that it's only superficially relativistic. Yes, if you did a survey, people on the street would, by some majority, say that moral truths are only relative to our preferences and desires and so on. But I think you would probably also observe, for example, that some of the big social justice movements of that have happened in the last decade or so very much seem to imply that there is a moral law. So the Me Too movement, for example, I think it's quite clear that the idea that men can't just kind of treat women as playthings, that's not a claim about what we would prefer. That's a claim that is supposed to be sort of true across all contexts, even in contexts such as, you know, when Harvey Weinstein was kind of setting out on his career. It was true then, even if that wasn't something that most people would have said, you know, that they thought that, in fact, there were objective standards about how men and women ought to relate to each other that weren't being respected then. So I think, again, this is one of those points at which Lewis's way of investigating our thoughts and ways of acting in the world would reveal that we actually do think that there are objective moral truths.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that he talks about in quite a few of his books, but particularly in Mere Christianity in those opening chapters, is that he suggests that atheism struggles to find, struggles to provide a sufficient foundation for this objective morality. I think at one point he says atheism's too simple. How might an atheist philosopher respond to this challenge? You've obviously referenced a couple of atheist philosophers already, but just the idea that actually it's not sufficient foundation for this objective morality.
So I think, we talked about Eric Weilenberg, and so he would want to say that moral truths could just be, as it were, free-floating brute facts, a bit like mathematical truths on a certain construal, and that's enough. I suppose, so a pair of philosophers, Jerry Walls and David Baggett, have got a book on God and morality, where they explore this from a number of angles, and they engage with Weilenberg's critique, but another angle they consider is the sort of moral motivation aspect of things. And one point they make is that moral accountability is, you know, both sides of the debate can agree that there isn't ultimate moral accountability on atheism. And that there's a sense in which that looks like it could undermine the moral enterprise. So even if there is this realm of objective moral facts, if there's going to be no final accounting of things, does that sort of render the whole moral enterprise farcical in some sense? And so, yeah, and I think actually that, you know, Immanuel Kant was very much worried about this. And so he, in a sense, some people suggest that that's why he postulates a God, to sort of ensure that, you know, virtue and happiness will eventually come together. But I think that's another angle to the discussion, and it's not particularly one that Lewis explores in Mere Christianity, but it's certainly another aspect that's worth considering.
Yeah. Max, you've mentioned various different philosophers, many of whom were more contemporary than Lewis was, but how have some of Lewis's ideas perhaps been used by or developed or straight up rejected by some more contemporary philosophers?
Yeah, so I would say that in contemporary discussions of moral arguments for God, Lewis often does get mentioned, because really you don't have, unlike with design arguments or cosmological arguments for God, which have a long history going back centuries, moral arguments for God actually don't in a very clear way. And you possibly get some kind of moral argument in Kant. But really Lewis is someone in the 20th century who is one of the first people to give voice to this kind of idea that objective moral truths need grounding, and something mind-like is a better grounding than a non-mind, a reality in which that, you know, naturalism is true. But so I guess philosophers like certainly William Lane Craig, but also C. Stephen Evans, Jerry Walls, and David Baggett have all given arguments that do in many ways look quite a lot like Lewis's. And I think what they've tried to do is in effect try to refine that argument by trying to articulate more precisely what it is about objective moral obligations that makes them particularly hard to situate in a naturalistic universe.
Mm. That's really helpful. Max, has engaging with Lewis's argument from morality influenced your own philosophical or theological thinking in any way, do you think?
Yeah, I said when I was a 19-year-old, I read Mere Christianity for the first time, and I was impacted by that argument that he gives at the outset of the book. And I probably would have said before that I was a relativist about morality. So I think Lewis probably did shift me to owning an objectivist view of ethics. As I said, I mean, as to the second stage of that argument, that for me is where it's more ambiguous, kind of how strong that inference is. But I think philosophers today who trying to make the case for objective ethics, and it's worth saying many atheist philosophers today would be objectivists about morality, would give arguments that are in effect quite similar to the sorts of things Lewis was saying.
Yeah. Max, how does the argument for morality fit within the context for other arguments for God's existence? You mentioned that perhaps getting us to the sort of that first step is quite helpful, but are there other more convincing arguments for the existence of God from a philosophical perspective, do you think, than the argument for morality?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think Lewis's argument from reason is really interesting. The idea that basically our ability to reason, to get to true beliefs about the world, is not something that is at all easy to situate within a naturalistic framework. I think that's very interesting. I think somewhat relatedly, but not exactly an argument Lewis gave, are arguments from consciousness, that first person experience, that sort of what it's like to be me, what it's like to taste coffee and so on, that's something that's not what you would expect if naturalism is true, but it is what you would expect if there's mind at the foundation of the universe. And again, these wouldn't be arguments that get you all the way to Christian theism, but they would form part of a cumulative case for theism, broadly speaking.
So with that in mind, do you think the argument from morality has impacted Christian apologetics the way we do apologetics today?
I think undoubtedly. I mean, yeah, I think Lewis and then William Lane Craig have probably been the two figures in the 20th century who've popularized the use of moral arguments more than anyone else. So, I do think that Lewis has had a big influence on the shape of the sort of theism and atheism debate in that respect.
And finally, I guess it's one thing talking about this stuff in the ivory towers of philosophy, but are there any practical implications for individuals or societies if we accept Lewis's argument from morality? In other words, does it have any relevance for the average person who's not perhaps thinking of these deep philosophical questions on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely does. And there's actually an analogy that Lewis offers for the structure of morality, which I think is really interesting. And so it's basically, the analogy is with a fleet of ships, and the ships represent people, right? And so he uses this analogy to sort of draw out the way that there are three dimensions to the structure of the moral landscape. And so the first one has to do with the way each individual ship governs itself, ensures that it's seaworthy. So that clearly pertains to how we each kind of govern our own thought lives, our own inner lives, how we relate to our own bodies, that kind of thing. The second dimension pertains to the way that the ships navigate in relation to each other. So this is the realm of interpersonal relations, how society is organized. And the third one is the question of where the fleet of ships as a whole is heading. So the goal of human life, or the telos. as it were, to use the Greek term for the sort of, yeah, the end or the goal of human life. And basically Lewis's point there is just that if we neglect any one of those dimensions, we can't expect human flourishing to occur. And I think he would probably say that, you know, it's that third one in our contemporary situation that is most often neglected, or if not, its reality denied altogether. And so, yeah, I think thinking about how those three dimensions are all essential, and how, you know, our moral thinking may be completely neglecting one or more of those is something that will have a lot of practical implications.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.